Welcome to the Not Old Better Show. I'm Paul Vogelsang, and this is episode number 287. As part of our Art of Living author interview series, today we're speaking with Bryn Jonathan Butler. Bryn Jonathan Butler has written the new book titled The Grandmaster, Magnus Carlsen and the Match That Made Chess Great Again. For our Not Old Better audience, many of whom play chess, and for those who are teaching and then play chess with their grandchildren, and for those who don't play, this is an exciting and riveting story about a championship chess match and much more. First, and to properly set this book up, let me tell you a bit about Bryn Jonathan Butler. Butler is a freelance journalist and documentary filmmaker, and he writes for ESPN, SB Nation, Salon, and many others. You're probably connecting the dots here and know that Butler writes, among other things, about sports. But he doesn't just stand in the corner passively and write as an observer might. Bryn Jonathan Butler writes about boxing after sparring with champ Mike Tyson, and in doing so, was shortlisted for the Penn ESPN Award for Literary Sports Writing. That said, it brings us back to Butler's new book, Grandmaster, which reads like a sports story, complete with pampered, difficult athletes in Norway's Magnus Carlsen, the fast pace of any professional basketball game, and the tension of a soccer match shootout to decide the match. Yes, the book is about this amazing match that we'll be discussing, but Bryn Jonathan Butler goes well beyond the championship and the two competitors to investigate spectators, journalists associated with international chess, all beautifully woven together around the precise timing in New York City of President Donald Trump's coronation. Chess is a game millions around the world love and obsess over, and Grandmaster brings this to life in an entertaining manner that contains everything you ever wanted to know about chess. Please join me in welcoming to the Not Old Better Show via internet phone, Bryn Jonathan Butler. Bryn Jonathan Butler, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Bryn, it's just a pleasure to talk to you. I mentioned to you that I've had a chance to read the book, of course, The Grandmaster. Just love it. And I want to talk about that. And I want to start by just kind of a general question about the game of chess. Of course, this is about the world champion, the 2016 World Championship of chess that took place in New York City. So many interesting elements of timing took place there. But I guess I always like kind of to just start at the start. And I'm curious, what attracted you to the game of chess and writing about it in this level of detail?
Well, I think I was always interested in how uniquely chess could hurt you. Huh. And I discovered that at a very early age. I write about it a little bit in the early section of the book, that my mother worked in an antique shop, and I was casing all of these incredible objects where I had no idea of what their history was. And the chessboard just seemed to me to be the most elegant and mysterious and beautiful. And the moment I was shown how to play, I lost in what's called a fool's mate, two moves. And I couldn't believe how much it injured my ego and affected me. It was very, very painful. And it was unlike losing at any other board game or activity, and I just couldn't figure out why. And it sort of spooked me and suggested to me that the game could be cursed in some way, both with how appealing it is, but also just how disturbing it can be. And that was kind of the tip of the iceberg of wanting to understand its history. And then finding this ambassador in Bobby Fischer, who I became obsessed with, who seemed to embody both the extremes of such incredibly compelling genius at the game, but also encompassing its dark undertow, where it led him with madness and racism, you know, rampant anti-Semitism and cheering on 9/11.
It's a fascinating game. So many parallels in life. And these two combatants, these two gentlemen that you go into some detail about, referring to Norway's Magnus Carlsen and the Russian Sergei Karjakin, these two are almost dark in and of themselves, but they were really viewed to be kind of the great white hope of chess And they were viewed as part of this resurgence of the game. What was it about them that was supposed to kind of bring chess back, make it great again, as you say?
Well, it's one of the most interesting features about chess is when you think about what can capitalism not commodify successfully? Even protests to capitalism, take Che Guevara, the most reproduced image in the world, is of somebody who wanted to have nuclear weapons fired at New York. And yet he's a commodity, an incredibly lucrative commodity. But with chess, you have a game that 600 million people play on Earth, that's been around for 1,500 years, and nobody knows how to make any money off of it. So this was their effort to try. And you had somebody that they're arguing, and Magnus Carlsen is potentially the greatest chess player ever, against an opponent who's the youngest grandmaster in the history of the game, with Putin backing. So you have some of that echoes of the Cold War that made Bobby Fischer so compelling in 1972 against Boris Spassky. It just seemed like the ingredients were there to really push, as they were trying to, that more people are playing this game than are playing poker or playing tennis. Why can't chess be as compelling as poker? And what you soon discover is it's very hard to make people tune in, let alone pay to watch. Two millennials play six-hour games day after day after day that are ending up in draw after draw after draw, which isn't to say I didn't find it compelling or that many people didn't, but it's a tough sell for people with this attention span.
Well, the book is compelling. We're, of course, with Bryn Jonathan Butler. The book is titled The Grand Master. Would you say that maybe some of this spotlight that was being placed on chess was being directed at maybe the wrong people? Maybe Carlsen and Karjagin themselves weren't the best of representatives or ambassadors. And you say even that these two were impenetrable. You know, that's a quote that's used in describing them. What made them so reluctant to lead the charge on behalf of chess?
You know, Paul, I wish I knew, because in the lead up to this, it was, no, he's in preparation for both of them in terms of talking to them. There's no way that he can talk to you in the lead up to this. And I thought, why not? And then it was, we're in New York and we're playing. So even on the days off, he needs to recover from the game. Okay. And then after it, well, there's more tournaments for him to go to. There's just never a good time that anybody associated with organizing the event or in representing these two guys. You know, I've gained access to some pretty big names in sport.
Yeah.
You know, be it anybody in boxing or Lance Armstrong,
right,
people making hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of their careers. And this was an event where about $5 million was spent to organize the entire event in New York. So it was puzzling to me just in terms of scale. Most people in New York didn't really know this was going on, because that's where chess is in the United States. It's it struggled before and after Bobby Fischer. You know, Bobby Fischer made it front page news in the New York Times while Watergate and over 50,000 Americans getting killed in Vietnam was going on. That's not likely to happen again. And the push of these organizers seemed to suggest that Bobby Fischer exposed how compelling chess was, whereas I think a more honest argument is that chess exposed how compelling a character Bobby Fischer was. And I'm not defending that or trying to impugn chess. I just think part of its beauty is that 1,500 years and 600 million people playing it, and it's still mysterious and troubling. And a lot of experts I brought in that love chess but are very successful at their fields all had a kind of similar ethos that they were tapping into about chess, in that it's dangerous. And I love that. I love that a board game could be seen as dangerous by so many people.
And you get that. You get that in reading the book, because there is this tension, we all know about that, between the spectators, the journalists that are covering the sport, those people become very much of interest to you. Tell us maybe a couple stories about those people and why they were so fascinating to you as kind of a group.
Well, one of my favorites is I think opening day of the match, I was on the escalator. There were a number of long, almost cartoonish, Warner Brothers cartoonish escalators to get up to the top of the Fulton Market. And there was a man I was riding with, and throughout my career with journalism, I find a lot of the best anecdotes are from taxi drivers or just on the way to something. You get people who have almost a more interesting take than experts. And this guy who was riding up was, you know, palpably nervous. And we were still 2 hours before the first pawn was going to move. And I asked him, you know, what drew you here? And he'd spent thousands of dollars to come in to watch the game. And I said, what on earth could justify this when you could just have it on your, you know, your computer and just be following the moves? And he said, well, I used to play chess, but I didn't have the constitution to be able to handle the nerves. So I went into open heart surgery instead.
Wow.
And there was no sense that this was a completely surreal statement, but you found many other people saying, I had somebody I knew who was a prodigy at math or physics, and I just knew chess was a dangerous thing to expose them to as kids. And in several cases, those people were introduced to chess and just dropped everything, and fell into this kind of oblivion of chess obsession where you can't really make the money to service yourself, so you fall into poverty. But you know, they lost wives, they lost children, like whole careers. And I was fascinated. I've always been fascinated by obsession and addiction. But there are a few things out there for a certain kind of person that can compel them the way this game can. And so I was very interested in sort of circling around these two competitors who I found very interesting. But to see the kind of people that chess draws in became almost as compelling an exploration of the subculture of chess, if 600 million people can be called a subculture. But I just love the stories that I found from ordinary people and from people that are masters at their respective professions as well.
Yeah, again, I love the book. I think my audience is going to love it as well. Bryn, I live just outside of D.C. The National Chess Center is in downtown D.C. I've taken my two sons there, and I'm always amazed at just the sheer volume of people and the dedication to the kid by the kids and their parents towards this game. It is really amazing. I'm going to ask you to read a couple of lines from the book for us, Bryn. But one of the lines that I read that I thought was really telling about the whole story is, you say, if more people cared about that championship, referring to the 2016. World Chess Championship, this would have been a very different book. And I think there might be some that would say, well, that's obvious. But what did you mean by that?
Well, I meant that I was the seventh row of the Manny Pacquiao-Floyd Mayweather fight in Las Vegas, where some tickets were going, like just to have one seat for $350,000. And one of the competitors in that fight made over $200 million for 36 minutes of essentially playing tag with his opponent. So this entire event was $5 million, which would be, you know, 15 seats at that fight could have paid for the entire event that went on for 3 weeks in New York. And I think America is a place, for better or worse, where if you can't make a dollar from something, regardless of its quality, nobody will take it seriously. And I think chess suffers from that in this country, in that Bobby Fischer making the same kind of money as Muhammad Ali to play Boris Spassky forced people to take it a lot more seriously. And now, you know, even back in 1992, when Fischer came out of his disappearing act to play Spassky in a meaningless rematch, he made $5 million for that. That's a lot of money in 1992 relative to other sports, what stars were earning. So it got massive coverage. These guys were playing for $1 million, which is nothing to sneeze at here in New York in 2016. But it's still that's still what people are really concerned with when it comes to sports, just as they are with movies, is we're talking about box office more than as a means of measuring the quality of things. We look at what did they get for it, as opposed to what did we get from it in terms of quality. And I question that logic, but I also just think it's just where we're at in this country.
The book The Grand Master is wonderful. Bryn, Jonathan Butler, we're going to put links up to where my audience can find the book. We'll put links up to where they can find out a little bit more about you. We really so appreciate your time. What an interesting person you are, interesting author, and this book is just doubly interesting. I wonder if we could ask you to read just maybe a couple lines, just something that's important to you out of the book.
Well, I'm gonna read, if you don't mind, the opening couple paragraphs, because I think it frames the event in an interesting way, because this was a championship where only 36 hours before Donald Trump was elected. And it was as if the city was in a kind of collective nervous breakdown, because I think around 80% of this city voted for Hillary Clinton. And yet, the only place in New York where people didn't seem concerned with politics was the World Chess Championship. So the analogy that I used was, it felt like being in the games room of the Titanic, where nobody cared about what was going to happen after we hit the glacier. It was just who's winning at the games that are being played. So there is some precedent for that. I found two of them. So this is the opening of the book. The chapter title is A Night at the Plaza. In 813 AD, a fratricidal power struggle and civil war saw Baghdad, the capital of the Islamic Empire, buried under a ceaseless hail of rocks, an inferno of burning pots of oil. The Tigris River was aflame with ignited rafts, stained in human blood, and bloated with bodies and sunken boats. After 2 years of raging civil war between Caliph al-Amin and his half-brother al-Ma'mun, starved defenders gave up their last ounces of strength, desperately trying to reinforce the gates. Urban warfare continued to rage in the streets as the naked army, mostly amateur troops of African origin, comprised of street vendors, market sellers, even inmates from prison who went into battle without armor of any kind or body protection, offered their last gasp of the city's defense. As the artillery of catapults flung heavy stones, arrows soared, and battering rams and swords crashed, far removed from the action, shielded by an abundance of walls, gates, and imperial guard, and tranquilly sitting beneath the green dome of the Golden Gate Palace, Caliph al-Amin, the sixth caliph of the Abbasid dynasty, ignored the overwhelming chaos and onslaught outside his kingdom. Instead, as his various palaces burned into the night, he focused on a chessboard and pondered his next move. I'm going to jump ahead a little bit. 8 centuries later, and more than 2,500 miles northwest of Baghdad in England, in the winter of 1648, a messenger arrived at the court of King Charles I with dire news. The messenger found the king hopelessly absorbed in a game of chess on his precious ember board. The board had been a gift from his father, King James I. It was built by George Schreiber, renowned as the King of the Games Boards, in Konigsberg in 1607, constructed from preciously small amounts of amber that had washed up onto the shores of the East Sea. In between moves, Charles read the message. The Scots had betrayed him. He remained seated and gave no indication of the missive's contents to his royal court by any gesture or expression on his face. Instead, he kept playing. The message was tantamount to the king's death warrant, yet the game continued. When Charles was executed on January 30th, 1649, the first English monarch ever to be put to death, he was allowed to carry two belongings with him to the scaffold where he was beheaded. He chose a Bible and his chessboard. A bishop named William Juxon read Charles his last rites atop scaffolding with a hooded executioner looking on, and the king's last action before placing his head on the block was to offer the Bible and the chessboard to the bishop as a gift. Jump ahead to the afternoon of November 10th, 2016, 2 days after Donald Trump was elected the 45th president of the United States. Thousands swarmed the Trump International Hotel and Tower near Manhattan's Columbus Circle. A mile away at Trump's Fifth Avenue residence, protesters battered a piñata of the president-elect. Police closed down the avenue at 57th Street and barricaded demonstrators. I watched one kid nestled inside the mob drop an American flag on the ground while his friend squeezed a stream of lighter fluid over it. Someone else bent over to reach down toward the flag, their Zippo's flame delicately fluttering in the frigid cold to ignite the bonfire. And only a few blocks away, I was headed to the Plaza Hotel for the opening night of the World Chess Championships. So, yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful book. It just literally, it takes off from there. And Bryn Jonathan Butler, what a pleasure it is to hear that read by you. It's just a great ending to just a fascinating time and a fascinating sport and game. Thank you, Bryn Jonathan Butler, for joining us again. We'll put links up where you can find all the work by Bryn Jonathan Butler, including The Grand Master, which we've been talking about today. But Bryn Jonathan Butler, thank you so much again for your time today.
Thank you for your time, Paul. I appreciate it.
Again, my thanks to Bryn Jonathan Butler and his new book, The Grand Master, Magnus Carlsen and the Match That Made Chess Great Again. My thanks as well to you, the Not Old Better audience. And remember, let's talk about better, the Not Old Better show. Thanks, everybody.